Thanks for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're taking a look at birds and birding on the program today with Bill Volkert. He's a retired wildlife DNR educator, naturalist, worked at the Horican Marsh for 27 years. And Bill's written a number of books and has led many bird-watching tours. We'll probably maybe talk about one of them as we move along today. But we want to hear from you. Tell us which birds are brightening your day these days. Maybe you need some help identifying a bird or a bird song. Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, Larry, thank you. Always a pleasure to be here. And this is a special show, a bit of a sad one. This is our last one.
Yeah, our last one together. Yes. You'll be coming back.
Oh, sure.
probably not, but that's all right.
Yeah, we'll be doing that with another host, but it won't be quite the same. We'll pick up where we left off, of course.
Yeah.
You know, when I think back a little bit, I can't remember when we first started this. I believe it was around 1988, certainly 1990 at the latest.
So
we've been doing this for 35 years. And I think it's somewhere around 200 programs. What an opportunity for me to be able to share our love of birds and to be able to answer questions for so many people out there.
It's been a lot of fun.
You know, at Horican Marsh, as you mentioned, 27 years, I had over 220,000 visitors that I could meet with, which, you know, it took me a quarter century to do. I come on the air here, we get half that many or plus in a single one. So, I mean, what a chance to talk to a lot of people. And you know, it's because of the network that you have that we reach statewide and people listen online.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just given us a real opportunity to share this with such a vast audience. But that's technology, just that we have that capability. You still have to get them to tune in. And I think the important thing there is you've got the personality. We've got you. You know, this is what people do. You're so relaxed and engaging in your style. And you've certainly been able to bring people in every day like this to listen to this show. And I think one thing people should be reminded of is that unlike television, it's just your voice.
Yeah.
And
it is.
You know, I think some people might think, well, he just talks, he asks questions, interviews people. I can do that. That seems easy. But, you know, as I think about it, it reminds me a little bit of watching a top athlete. They'd also make it look easy. And I, you know, you think to yourself too, oh, I can do that. And, you know, you give it a try. And about the time they release you from the emergency room, you realize what all goes into it. So there's really that art of being a radio host. And I certainly appreciate it. And I'm sure thousands of people no doubt do. So thanks so much for all the years of you being a host, being a colleague and being a friend and inviting me back. I really appreciate that. So let's do this one more time. Let's hear what the listeners have to say as we talk birds.
We got lots of people. And thank you, Bill. It's been a real pleasure and honor for sure. And here we are. We're getting into summer where, I mean, this is the time of the year we have, I think, our largest bird population in the state.
Yes. Essentially, the migration is over as we get into June. So when we do the breeding bird surveys, when we want to census which birds are present at certain areas during that nesting season, at least as potential nesters. Southern Wisconsin, we start in the 1st of June. Northern Wisconsin, we like to wait until the 15th for a couple of those last stragglers that are still heading up to Canada. And at that time, we've got the male singing on territory, and we watch for the birds, and we do our surveys to take a look what is present on the breeding ground. As we get into this nesting season, that's, of course, where they're adding to the population, and that will be the largest, the number of birds for the year with all those young that are being raised here.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And there's plenty of songs out there. It's a really fun to get up early in the morning and get out around the neighborhood, even in the city of Madison neighborhood that I live in. The birds are singing up a storm.
They're starting just before sunrise.
Yes.
And bird watchers have referred to this for a long time. It's the dawn chorus.
Yeah.
So even before the sun actually comes up, about 4:30 or so, you'll start to hear that first bird starting to sing, and they really start to chime in just as the sun comes up. And then things settle down a little bit, and they'll start calling throughout that whole morning time until it really starts to heat up.
Lots of fun being out there that early in the day. Herb in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Herb.
Yep. Hi. Hi, Larry. And about the year 2000, my wife and I were in a rented little cabin in France, in the Lot Valley. And there was only the owners of the place around us and absolutely no other people. And around early morning, around 7 o'clock, I heard a sound that sounded like one of those alarm clocks, one of those Tozai alarm clocks that go beep, 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 and something like that. But the owners of the place said they didn't have it, and we didn't have it. And I'm wondering if this could have been a bird imitating one of those clocks.
There are some birds that will do imitation. The ones that are most known for that, some of the mynas, and also some of the birds of paradise in New Guinea are just extraordinary mimics. We have a group of birds called mimics here, which includes our catbird, our brown thrasher, the mockingbird. And essentially, they're just in this whole long song, they will incorporate the sounds of other birds. So they're just mimicking, say, other bird songs as part of their repertoire. Yeah, there are some birds around the world that have this capability of mimicking artificial sounds. I remember there was one in New Guinea where he was actually sounding like a chainsaw off in the distance. They'll pick up all kinds of, and also the shutter sounds of the cameras because of all the people sitting in the blind and taking pictures. He just picked that up too. But in Europe, we don't have any that I know of that are quite that good as mimics. But then again, I'm not entirely familiar with all the birds in Europe either. But yeah, there's certainly that capability among some of them.
So it's a mystery, Herb. We're not sure if it was a bird imitating or a frog or some other animal.
But I will say this. Try to download the Merlin app.
Yeah.
And it's a free app for your cell phone. And it's from Cornell University. And you can load on various what they call bird packs. So when you get into the menu, you can take a look and just scan all these different countries, and you can load that as a file on your phone and use that to identify bird songs. And I would encourage anybody out there that has any interest in bird songs, download that, and all you do is just hit sound ID, hold your phone up, and it'll tell you all the birds that you're hearing around you. It is a great way to be able to learn bird songs quickly. And as I tell my brother, what took me 40 years to try to memorize, he's got right on his phone instantly.
Herb, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Rob in Appleton has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Rob.
Hey, guys. Hey, I love this show. I love the animal one for sure. And I can vouch for the Merlin app as well. I have it all the time out in the backyard. I just want to share a story because it's a pretty wonderful thing to happen. We live in around the river, and we had a huge maple tree. And when my oldest, who's now 19, was around 7, he spotted an eastern screech owl in the tree. It took me probably another 2 minutes to actually see it because it looked, you know, obviously just like the tree when it was in the hole. And he decided to make a little front yard learning experience, and adults came over, and he taught everyone about eastern screech owls. Since then, the tree has been taken down, which is sad because we had lots of families. And just last night, I was out for a walk, and I found the eastern screech owls. They had moved up the road, and they had 6 little babies that had just fledged and were sitting on the wires. So it's just a great
story, and I bet Lee's already got an eastern screech owl up. Let's listen to the call. There we go.
There's that little screech.
Yeah, yep, that's it. And then when the babies make a little kind of like a when it's getting dark.
Yeah. Well, first of all, congratulations to your son that he took such a strong interest and attachment to them, and not only was studying and watching the birds of his own, but wanting to get other people interested and share that. Good for him.
Rob, thank you very much for sharing that with us. Tim and Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Tim.
Hi. How are you doing, Larry?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you, Tim?
Well, I wanted to ask a technical question, and hopefully your guest can help me, because I was reading or listening to something the other day that said that when a hawk, and they didn't specify a species, they said when a hawk is going to hit like a pigeon or something, it folds its wings and throws its talons in front of it and falls at like 200 miles an hour. And they claim that the pigeon is not killed by the claws, it's killed by the impact.
The stun.
Now, my question, my question is, how come the pigeon's killed and the hawk gets dinner? Wouldn't you think that two cars crash, the car that does the crashing doesn't usually get away unscathed.
So good point.
Why is that? Is the hawk built somehow specially? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, thanks, Tim.
Yeah, good question. Now, what they're talking about is not technically hawk. This is the hunting technique of the peregrine falcon, which is always cited as the fastest bird, fastest animal in the planet. And that's in its stoop or its power dive. And they've been known to hit speeds over 180 miles an hour. So what they're doing is, they'll fold the wings, which basically is to make them like a bullet. They'll come in at a steep dive, and yes, they hit them with the chest. Now, the chest, you have, first of all, that chest bone, the sternum, and then the heavy breast muscles, which is for flight. So in other words, this is a hawk that's got a very powerful chest, and not necessarily killing the bird, unless it's a very small songbird that it's taking, but what it's doing is... the old name, by the way, it was the pigeon or duck hawk.
Duck hawk.
And so they can take some pretty good sized birds. And what they're doing is getting them to tumble and to disorient. And so with that, if they say, don't even really kill it, but just knock it out of the air, turn them into a spiral, he can then swoop around, come down, and while the bird is out of control, quick snatch them. And that's really the technique. Small songbirds, there may be enough impact to actually kill it. Larger birds, it's just stunning them, really to get them off balance and then to capture them.
Then capture them. Mm-hmm. Thanks much for that question. Appreciate it.
Peregrine falcon, by the way, also has another interesting technique. A lot of times, and you'll see red-winged blackbirds going after red-tailed hawks where they're above the tail. They don't want to get underneath the talons. Yeah. And so they're harassing them. They're flying above them and trying to drive them out of the territory as at least a perceived threat. Peregrine falcon, what he'll do is he'll let that bird keep following him. He'll take them up higher and higher and higher where all of a sudden there's no escape anymore. And then he turns on them. Very clever.
There you go. That's a cool story. Mark in Sussex. That was Mark with his comment.
Hello.
About bird. Yeah.
Hi. I wanted to mention something about bird strikes and what you were commonly told to do, I think, is erroneous information. They say if you have a bird strike, a bird hits the window and you find it there, is to put it in a box. That's the worst thing you can do. I had a chestnut-sided warbler the other day, hit the window, it fell into the bushes, it was upside down, so I righted it, left it stay in the bushes, in the shade, and it flew away. If you take a bird, unless it's laying out in the grass, in the hot sun, or in the sidewalk, and you put a live, healthy bird in a box, it will probably die in a couple hours. So if you get a bird strike, try and find a place in the shade, upright, put the bird upright, and just leave it.
Yeah. Okay, so the reason for putting it in a paper bag or a box, I'll get to that in a bit. But if the bird is severely stunned, like you say, you don't want it out in hot sun and exposure, or you also don't want to, say, just leave it sitting on a deck where it could easily be picked up by a predator because he's now stunned and incapable of flying. Putting it into a box or a paper bag, it's dark. They think it's nighttime to relax, and it gives them a chance to recuperate. It's not hours that you do that. It really takes only about 5 minutes, and when you start to hear them rustle and get a little excited, you can let them go. It's a little bit of a recovery area for them. So that's the reason for that. So that can work. The problem is, once the bird flies away, we don't know if it suffered some severe internal injuries and may perish anyhow. Just because he escapes doesn't mean that he's completely healthy. So the best we can do is prevention, and I really want to stress this. If anyone has a window where birds tend to periodically collide with it, please do something to keep them safe. And it's a very simple technique. You need a visual barrier so that the birds do not think they can fly between it. What they're trying to do, of course, they see the reflection of trees and you think that that's a safe escape. They don't know what glass is. And that's why you have the window collision. What I did at home is we put a tape on the window. It was just little stripes, and they should be 4 inches apart or less, so that songbirds look at that, and it's too narrow to fly between. What we have right now is an older product. It's quite visible to the birds and also a little bit to us. We just learned to ignore it. There are new products that are all but invisible to people, and I'd recommend anybody who's looking to do something to reduce this, go to the American Bird Conservancy website, abc.org, and just look at window collision, and they'll give you a variety of different products out there. And it's estimated that well over 100 million birds die on our windows every year. And we know that birds are in trouble from a lot of things. This is the easiest fix we can do. There are a lot of other conservation challenges to try to protect and preserve the bird populations, but this is something that homeowners can do. And especially, you know, if you have one window more than others where you have those collisions, and I know some people say it's only 4, 5, or 10 birds a year. Think about that for every home. It adds up, and you can do a lot for that. So strongly consider that. Thank you.
Bill Volkert, our guest today, a retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Great to have him with us here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.
Support for WPR comes from All Energy Solar and Fair Share CSA Coalition. Your business or organization can partner in providing the WPR programs that enrich our communities. Join at WPR.org/sponsor.
We're talking birds and birding today. Larry Mueller here with our guest Bill Volkert, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. You can email the talk at WPR.org. Wayne in Appleton has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. I do have questions about hummingbirds, but first, I got a quick story. I used to work out at the airport, and an aircraft was doing engine runs on the ramp, and a peregrine falcon got into the jet blast and pinned it against the fence. So it stayed there for a while, you know, in the fence. And after they did their engine runs, we went out to get it, and we put it in a box without a top. And it just, the word went around the whole hangar. And just so happened there was two people in the back shop that were part of a bird rehab place here in Appleton. And then they were able to rehab it and let it go. That was a cool story.
Yeah, very cool.
I can't
cool.
believe it's alive.
So that was a real shock for that bird, yes.
Yeah, I mean, it got, you know, they were kind of at power, you know. And so anyways, hummingbirds, where's a good place to, I got a couple questions. And I could stay online, but in case you guys got one. Where's a good place to keep a feeder? Because right now my feeder is in the tree and some of the branches grew around it. So I'd like to know, do they go to feeders because of the color? And maybe they can't see it. Where do hummingbirds migrate to? And has anybody, any kind of biologist, estimates or have an idea of how many wing flap cycles does it take to get to their migration? You know, and how many per second? And then real quick, and then I'll be done. I was on the deck reading. I was underneath a hanging plant, and a hummingbird came by. It was really close to my ear. I could not believe how loud it was. So that's what I got.
All right. Well, you got lots there, Wayne. Yeah. That's for sure.
So they get their name hummingbird from that wing beat, that buzz mm-hmm. that you'll hear. They also do a little sharp squeak that you can pick them out by. So first question just on feeders. You want those out in the open. You mentioned that the tree's starting to grow around with the branches. You want to have it somewhat open area so it's easy to see. And, yes, they do see in color like almost all birds do, except the owls. And with that, it's the bright red. This is why you always have that red on the feeding portion of the bird feeder itself, the hummingbird feeder, to attract them. And I've had them fly up. I remember sitting around a campfire with a pair of old socks that had a red band on it. Out of the blue, a hummingbird came by, hovered in front, took one look at it. So that's the color that attracts them. So, yeah, you want to hang that feeder out where they have good access and visibility to it. As far as where do they migrate to, our ruby-throat hummingbird goes to Central America. So we're talking about a flight of a good 2,000 miles each way. And if in case this even comes up, the old myth that they ride on the backs of Canada geese, and no, they do it all on their own. And I think part of that is it's hard to believe. So if you want to get your calculator out, you want to say how many wing beats does it take? Average wing beat for hummingbird is about 70 or 75 a second. And when they do their power dives as the displays that you flight, it may be almost up to 200 wing beats a second. So now if they're doing 70 wing beats a second, they can fly 25 to 30 miles an hour. It's 2,000 miles. Figure it out.
You can do the math on that.
Give me a number on that. Yeah.
It's a lot of flaps.
It's a lot. It's an awful lot. So, yeah, that's what we have as statistics on the hummingbird.
All right. Wayne, thank you very much for calling. Brad in Door County, your turn. Hi, Brad.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking the call. See, I appreciate all of the time and your service to public radio. I've learned a tremendous amount over the years.
Thank you.
And my, I don't know if it's really a question. It's more of an oddity that I've never experienced before. It had a female cardinal who kept hitting the window. And this is late April, early May. And so we did some online searches to find out exactly what to do. Put up decals in the window, that didn't stop it. Put tape on the outside, that didn't stop it. Closed the drapes 24 hours a day, didn't stop it. Just went on for weeks and weeks and weeks, and the earlier the sun came up, that earlier that bird would hit the window. Finally got bird netting, strung it from the top of the house down to the ground. And for, maybe 2 weeks now, went away. So I'm like, okay, good. Take that bird netting down. I could see out my window. So like 3-4 days later, bird was back hitting it again. So I don't really, I guess the question is how long does something like that go on? I'm not really wanting to keep bird netting over my windows for the entire summer, but.
Yeah. Yep. Understand. It's basically for the nesting season, and cardinals can have more than one brood, one nesting in a year. And it may go on until at least midsummer. You're talking about probably a good month yet. And what this is, of course, the bird seeing its reflection in the window. It's what I have always called shadow boxing. So it's usually the males. Cardinals, the females also are fairly brightly colored, that bright bill, and can be a little aggressive trying to claim a territory there with its mate. So this is what they're doing, is they're seeing another bird there. They're flying against the window, trying to chase it away. They flutter away, and they turn around. It's like, good, got rid of him. As soon as they do a U-turn, look around, there he's back again. I've had them also doing the same thing with the mirrors on cars.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have is an unfortunate habit of an individual. Cardinals, robins quite commonly, and the goldfinches. These are the three main ones that will, because they're around the homes very commonly, and these are the brightly colored birds that will commonly get this habit. And out of the whole flock of all the robins and cardinals out there, every so often one individual gets into that habit. The first thing to do is when you first see that bird doing it, try to break the habit early before they become obsessed. And, of course, now you're too far down the road. That bird is obsessed with trying to get it, the perceived competitor out of the neighborhood. And I've already had the same thing where I've tried to block a window, and I get the bird to stop, at least on that window. Then it goes around the corner, finds another one. And I've had it probably every 5 to 8 years or so an individual bird gets into this habit. So it's something we just have to deal with.
Brad, there you go. Yep. Thanks so much. You mentioned robins a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And robins, and you mentioned nesting of another bird, but robins, if I'm not mistaken, they will do up to 3 in a year, will they not? We even have a robin song. Let's just do that robin song.
Yeah, let's listen.
Yeah.
A little bit of a rolling to it, back and forth. Nice, sweet song to it. In Wisconsin, at least 2 nestings a year for a pair. If they start early, it's a little exceptional that you might have 3 broods. One certainly, and those are usually the first-time nesting birds. They'll raise at least 1 family. 2 broods is not too uncommon. And, of course, again, talking about a little bit of annoyance for bird shadow boxing, the other problem is robins that want to nest right by your front porch. They're on the lights or something like that.
Yeah.
That's, again, something that you want to deal with very early on. Federal law does not allow us to destroy nests. I had a pair of robins that were just bringing the first nesting material in where the gutter downspout makes it bend toward the house. And I just saw the first few strands of grass, and it's like, that's not where I want to see all the droppings and all the problems there. And I don't want to harass the bird every time I go in and out of the door. So what I did is I just removed that nesting material, the very first few strands of it, and I was able to take a cardboard box and fold it into there. In other words, just create a bit of a physical barrier so the bird is not able to nest on that site, found a new place for itself, and they're happy, so am I.
Well, you know, with all the rain we've had in some parts of the state, the robins have been pulling worms I'm and night crawlers.
Yeah, that food comes to the surface, and there's plenty of free pickings for them out there.
Yep, absolutely. Mike in Sun Prairie has something. Let's go there. Hi, Mike.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Good. 2 quick questions. The first one, the primary one, was I have noticed, you guys were talking about birds that mimic, and I have noticed the blue jays in my neighborhood will mimic, like, predatory birds, specifically like a hawk or a falcon. And so I'm wondering, when I read online, that seems to be true, and wondering how they use that and what they use it for. And then the second thing is I had a northern brown flicker, had a nest, and they've just had the babies are popping out. They made a nest in an old squirrel hole in a birch that I have, and don't know much about the bird. Just wondering if there's anything you could tell me about the northern brown flicker.
Sure.
Yeah. Well, the flicker is a member of the woodpecker family. So they excavate a cavity, and that's where they raise the young. Unlike most of our woodpeckers, yes, they will look for insects in the tree bark, but they also will come to the ground, and ants is a big food for them. So they're a little bit unusual that way. And especially as we get into August, September, as they're gathering up and getting ready for migration, I've oftentimes chased up 3, 4, 5 flickers that are together where there's a good gathering of ants. And they'll be on the ground, and as you walk along, you'll see several of them fly away. Easy to recognize. They've got the yellow in the wing lining and a big bright white spot on the rump. So it's one of the larger of our woodpeckers.
In terms of the blue jays and imitating.
Yeah, blue jays are interesting because they really have a very elaborate vocabulary. These are very sociable, very gregarious birds, and because of that, they communicate with each other in many different ways. So there's a lot of vocalization where most birds have just a few simple kinds of call notes that they make, contact calls, warning calls. Blue jays have just this whole variety, and I've never even tried to count all the different sounds that they make. And yeah, one of the more unusual ones is that they will make an imitation of red-tailed hawk, which is pretty good, but it's being a smaller bird, it doesn't have that force and quite that volume to it. So you can usually pick it out. I had one this morning. I've been hearing it for a while. We have red-shouldered hawks in our neighborhood. He does red-shouldered hawk. He's pretty good at it. I can, again, always tell the difference. The one that I cannot distinguish them from the actual hawk is the broadwing, because the broadwing just has this very soft little call, and blue jays are really good at it. And if I hear that, if I have both of them in a neighborhood, which I had several years ago, I would have to go to look to see who's actually making the noise and see if it's actual broadwing or just an imitation.
I think Lee's got a oh, here we go, blue jay.
And not typical, because we normally think of the J call, which is where they get their name.
Yeah.
And just this whole variety, the variety of different sounds that people have captured from them. It's just amazing. And actually, for scientists, the only way that we can even try to identify all those songs, it's hard to keep those all in your head and try to count the variations of all the different calls. You have to actually record them and take a look at that voice print, the sonogram. And with that, you'd have to look at your library of all the recordings of what's out there. But, yeah, they've got a lot to talk about, apparently.
Mike, thank you again. Appreciate the call. Paula in Manitowoc, what's on your mind?
Good morning. How are you?
We're doing great. Thank you for calling.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I was in northern Wisconsin over the past weekend in Vilas County, right up on Fence Lake. And, you know, we always have all sorts of fun playing with the Merlin Bird app, trying to identify the different birds that are around us, and then trying to call them in. Well, it was dusk, and it was pretty dark, and there was just a tiny little bird that was, you know, popping around the base of this oak tree. And it was blue. And, you know, we couldn't figure out what it was. And I think by going through the Merlin Bird app, we figured out it was a cerulean warbler, which typically is not found in northern Wisconsin. And then we, you know, used the app to call it in. And it was really fun because it came right into us within really just about 10 feet maybe. So we could definitely identify what it was. But how common is this cerulean warbler in northern Wisconsin?
Not very common at all. In Wisconsin, cerulean warbler is a threatened species. It's a real habitat specialist in the mature southern forests. Best populations are going to be in the driftless area. I remember a number of years ago I was out in Governor Dodge. I had quite a few of them there. That's a good spot. Wyalusing, that corner of the state is good. I live in the northern Kettle Moraine. We have very few individuals there. And as a threatened species, yeah, they're not doing real well. What you probably had to find an individual in northern Wisconsin is a young bird, I'm guessing, probably returning for the first time and overshot its normal territory. Mm. Got going on a good wind, headed north. And we'll see this occasionally. Birds, especially in the early part of the migration, get out of range, and then they try to do a little course correction, find their way back again. I'm glad you're mentioning about the Merlin app as a way to identify it, and I guess you're able to bring it in with the playback. Just a little bit of note of caution for people. Playback works really well to play those bird songs and to bring them in, but you also have to keep in mind that these are birds that are using those songs to establish territory, contact, and compete with others, and there has been some concern of overplay. In fact, in some places where rare birds are known to be, and bird watchers are really very focused on trying to find the individual, they've banned playback entirely. And so there's a number of sites where they just say this is just interfering with birds and harassing rare birds too much. So watch during the nesting season that we're not overdoing it, because it's now competition. And one quick chance to get a confirmed look. I think that's pretty innocent, not a big deal there. I've done that myself, especially when I'm traveling, trying to find rare birds. But yeah, overdoing it, you're starting to interfere a little bit with the birds' communication, competition. And we've actually had some cases where they figure, hey, there's just too much going on here. I can't compete with all these other birds, and they have failed the nest. So, yeah, don't overdo it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, great use of Merlin. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Paula. Appreciate it. Carol in Verona, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. So my call is about, we have put up bluebird houses for several years, and I've been in the Verona area for just a couple of years. And this year, we have put up two, and the tree swallows typically will inhabit one. And my understanding was that was good because they kind of kept other noxious birds out of the area. So they did that. They inhabited one, and the bluebirds inhabited the other one. And I was checking on it regularly, and I saw four nice little eggs in there, and I was so pleased. And then, sadly, we saw another bird at the box. I went out, and here, I'm sure it was a house sparrow, had robbed the nest and killed the bluebird, and so I sadly had this poor bluebird carcass in my box. My question is, this is the second time this has happened to me over the years. What can I do that I haven't been already doing to try and keep those swallows away from the bluebirds?
Well, I don't know how much space you have. I would suggest if you've got a little bit of extra room, try a few more boxes, space them far enough apart to give opportunity for all the different birds. I've got bluebird boxes out. Where I am, it's a little heavily forested, so I rarely get bluebirds. Well, probably every 5-6 years, I get one pair that nests there. I certainly welcome the tree swallows because this is a bird that populations have declined. And as a cavity nester, use of the bluebird boxes can certainly be beneficial for them. The thing you want to do, of course, is keeping the house sparrows out. It's a non-native bird. And as you've already indicated, that yes, they will go in and actually kill other birds in those boxes to try to keep down their competition and try to take it over. Best suggestion I would have is go to the website of the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin, BRAW, BRAW. And there's a whole series of different kinds of management tips. There's different box designs, how to monitor them, what to do for your pests and competition with it. And they've got a lot of good hints. So I would really suggest, yeah, check out that website.
It's a great organization. Really.
Yes, they've done a tremendous job in trying to restore the bluebird in Wisconsin, and they've been very successful with that over the years.
Carol, thank you so much for calling. A listener in Madison sent us a photo of a baby stork found and commented that they're really cute, and we do have the picture up, and they are really cute. And the listener wonders, how did these storks make their way to Wisconsin, or where did they come from?
Well, we have one native stork in North America, that is the wood stork. As we get into Central South America, there will be the very large Jabiru stork and Maguari stork in South America. For many years, our wood stork was listed as a federally endangered species. It may still be on that list, but there's been some real efforts in the southeastern U.S. to try to provide habitat and restore that population. And we've had wood storks moving out of that area because of the population increases. So the normal stronghold for them was certainly Everglades, which there's been a lot of effort to try to both maintain and even enhance the habitat there from all the human impacts. And along that southeastern coast, some of the wetland areas, that's really the stronghold for them. But as I say, they've been doing quite successfully with the restoration of that population, and we're starting to see the birds nesting in other areas nowadays.
We have a couple of callers online. You can join in too. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Visiting about birds today with our guest, Bill Volkert. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today as we talk birds with Bill Volkert. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening in. And Evan in Millidor has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Evan.
Hey, yeah, I'm Evan from Millidor here. I live by the mead. I grew up on a farm only like a mile away from the mead. I was taking a drive through the other day and I saw a bird and I never really seen it before. I'm colorblind, so I don't see half the colors you guys do, but it was a night heron. I was wondering how common those are around here. Oh.
Night heron.
Yes, black-crowned night heron is the one I would certainly guess it would be. So there are two species, yellow-crowned night heron and black-crowned night heron. And he's talking about the mead. What he means is the Mead Wildlife Refuge, yeah, which is in the Wausau area, central Wisconsin. So the yellow-crowned night heron is a more southern bird. We get a few exceptional sightings of the bird in Wisconsin. I think there's one or two nest records down in Kenosha area, but we're a little far north for that. We do have some colonies of black-crowned night heron. We used to have them at Horicon Marsh. They moved up into the Cattails many years ago where they're very hard to track and census. I know the Green Bay area has had a colony. So they are a colonial nester. So if you do find nest sites, there's going to be certainly more than one gathered together. But we also have some of the birds that are not breeding or early migration that are wandering around, making their way up toward the colonies, especially the young from last year that are looking for that colony and their first attempt to actually establish a nest itself. So, these kind of stragglers or wanderers are certainly not that common. If you get into a site where there's a colony nearby, there's a pretty good chance of seeing them. As the name indicates, night heron, they tend to do their fishing or hunting right around dawn and dusk and into the evening time. So they can be a little more reclusive during the daylight hours. They oftentimes like to hunker way back into the edge of the cattails and taking small fish, frogs, and especially crayfish as a food for them. So, yeah, always a good sight. It's a medium-sized heron, just a little larger than our green heron, so standing about, 12, 14, maybe 16 inches tall. Yeah.
All right. Evan, thanks. Appreciate your call. Karen in Madison has something. Let's go there. Hi, Karen.
Hi. First of all, I just want to thank you, Larry, and also say the guests that you have fall in the category of being great role models, teachers, learners, respectful, curious, aware of that they're a community of equals and that sharing and giving away their knowledge. And I appreciate it, and I appreciate you, Larry. You're quite unique. You really are. And the question I had was about robins and jumping worms. Do they eat jumping worms? And my second most burning question is, do cell phones affect birds? Because I know they affect bees, and I'm assuming they affect insects as well, because they affect bees strongly. And so have there been any studies on the detrimental effects of cell phones? And I'm just calling out to everyone and say, don't be a servant to your cell phone. You can use it for what it's good, but don't be a servant.
Well, Karen, thanks for all your comments. And as to her question,
cell phones, I don't know if there's been much research done, or certainly I have not come across anything as far as negative impacts. I don't know if or how birds are sensitive to that, or to what degree, or if this in any way interferes with the birds. I've not heard anything of that effect, so maybe it does not have quite that impact itself, she cites, for bees.
In terms of robins eating
jumping worms. Well, jumping worm is somewhat of a newer invasive species in Wisconsin. So it's a new food source for most of our robins in isolated parts of the state where they've now established themselves. I really don't know of, say, robins deliberately taking them, but I would think that most birds are opportunists. If it's a food you can handle, it looks good, as long as it doesn't have a serious bad taste to it, I'm sure they'll take them.
Yeah, that's true. I had a caller on another program call in and say she saw a robin eating her jumping worms, which she was so happy for.
Well, they'll take them, but they're just skimming the surplus. It's not going to suppress the population, unfortunately.
No.
But I think if it doesn't taste bad and if it's available as an opportunist, they'll take them.
Yeah. Karen, thank you again. Jim and Stevens Point. Hi.
Hello, Larry. Hey, I have to jump on the bandwagon, too, and really thank you. I've been delivering, rural Meals on Wheels for a number of years, and your coincides perfectly with your program. I just love the respect that you have for everyone and your upbeat attitude. So much appreciated.
Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, you bet. My topic, I called in last year about this. A method that my wife devised, and as I was calling in, I think I heard a gentleman describing using the bird netting, and we built this little framework out of small PVC piping over our sliding door off the deck where she has the feeder, so there are lots of birds coming in, and we were losing like half a dozen birds every season hitting the window. Anyway, I just had to say this again, because since we've had this netting up for about 3 years, zero hits. It's just and she angles it away enough so that we can get out the door and get out to the feeders and you know, go out on the deck. And it just worked so well. We've tried the tape and the ribbons and some ultraviolet stuff to some success, but this bird netting is it's been 100%. So I just want to put in a kick for that too.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot.
Well, good for you for finding a way to both save the birds and solve that problem of window collisions. There's a lot of different methods. The netting, as you say, I know some people have stretched it over, so it acts a little bit like a, not only a physical barrier but or visual barrier as well, but a bit of a trampoline if a bird does come into it. I know others who have tried the parachute cord, which is a heavier nylon so that the wind doesn't blow it around too much but just moves it a little bit side to side. You know, something like yarn wouldn't hang straight real well. So that works well if it's within 4 inches or less apart. Decals or stickers and things on the window, again, something that is placed close enough so the birds do not feel they can get between. There's a lot of different ways to do that. It's an important problem for us to solve.
Jim, thank you very much for the comments and for the story. Appreciate it. Joanne in Mesa Mani, on to you now. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. We had a mourning dove last year that nested 5 times outside our doorway. Is that unusual?
Wow, 5 times.
For Wisconsin, yes. In the southern states, they will nest that often because, the spring starts a little earlier for them. They can get nesting already in April and continue well into, say, August, early September. So up to 5 is not unusual. They usually lay just 2 eggs. They may not always be successful with every single one of those. That is, I have to say, quite exceptional for Wisconsin because we do have a shorter season here. For mourning dove, it's a bird that's a year-round resident, so they can start nesting earlier. You're going to have to wait for them to migrate, arrive here, establish a territory, find a mate, and then initiate nesting. So they get going a little bit or sooner. Usually 2-3 is a little bit more common for mourning dove. 4, unusual. 5, I think they're setting records out there.
They sure are. Joanne, thank you so much. MJ emailed us. He drives a semi for a living, and yesterday he was at Watoma, a very rural location, waiting about an hour to get unloaded, and he was enjoying a beautiful day with his truck off and the windows down while watching a few YouTube videos about crows. All of a sudden, the crow landed on his mirror about a foot away and just tilted its head and listened to his phone, and he was eating, MJ was eating grapes, and he slowly offered one to the crow, and it took it in almost no time, and then it would fly off and return and watch me for a while and have another grape.
Fantastic. Oh, making friends, a great way to pass the time, that's for sure.
Oh, man, he wonders, is this normal?
definitely not.
Well, it heard the crows.
Oh, he's making friends. Good for him. That's fantastic.
I love that story. Tom, have you got a quick comment for us?
Yeah, I was at a Brewers game, and a hummingbird hit the railing in front of us, and I caught it and just put it in my hand, and maybe a couple minutes it took off, so I don't know.
Ah!
Curious that it would hit the railing. There's usually... very good vision, good maneuverability. Something
Brewers,
had him disoriented.
Yeah, it was, well, yeah, it wasn't red either. We got blue and gold more or less for Brewers colors. But could have just gotten disoriented.
Yeah, accidents happen. Yeah. It's unusual for him to fly into a visual or a physical barrier like that or obstruction.
Well, Tom, thanks. I'm glad you just held on to it, and finally it took off.
Yep.
There you go.
Good for both of you.
Yep. Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, having some fun working with him today and talking with him today. He's worked at Hurricane Marsh for 27 years, a long time, and he's been a regular guest on our show for even longer, more like 30 years at least. And he's going to be with us for another hour. So we got a whole hour yet to talk with him. I see we have callers online. one or two, you can join in. And certainly if you don't want to call, you can send an email, because we have a few of those to cover as well. Take a quick look at the news, and then we'll be back with Bill Volkert. I'm Larry Mueller. Taking a look at birds today with Bill Volkert, a retired wildlife educator and naturalist working out of Horicon Marsh for 27 years. I'm Larry Mueller. Questions or experience to share with Bill about birds, give a call at 800-642-1234. And, of course, you can email the talk at WPR.org. And let's callers. Let's take a call from Mike in Baraboo next. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry and Bill. I'd like to share a little short story about my father, who was a columnist, here, outdoor columnist. And he was on assignment back in the early 60s to go up to the Horicon Marsh. And there were...
We lost him. Mike, I'm sorry. We can't hear your call. I'm very sorry. Well, maybe another time. Jessica in Fall River, let's go to you. Hi, Jessica.
Hi. Hi, Larry. Hi, Bill. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
So I observed something very interesting in my garden yesterday, and it was very haunting as well. So there's a catbird pair that are nesting in our lilac trees. And I've been hearing them at evening, you know, and in the morning calling, and they've been working on this nest. And while I was just, like, checking on all my plants, I heard a very distressing call from the catbirds. And I'm like, what in the world is going on here? So I know they've been, like, chasing around with some cardinals and doing other stuff in the yard. Well, then I got a closer look. And there was a cardinal in there, so I'm like, oh, are they having some dispute? And I saw a big, fat garter snake in the nest.
Mm.
And so I know that happens. We have a lot of garter snakes. My yard's very wildlife-friendly, so, you know, I let what happens. And so when I went to go check on it, it was still, like, kind of coming down from this intense situation. But then it flew off to another tree. And the cardinal followed, and then so did an oriole. An oriole came into the same tree, so they were all kind of in this situation. So it just, like, made me think, wow, is there, like, empathy among the different species when something distressing like this happens? And I've had cockatiels, like, all my life, so I kind of know when birds are stressed out, right? I mean, it seems obvious to me, but not to everybody. So I don't know. What are your thoughts?
Do birds have empathy?
Well, they were certainly all identifying the same threat. So they were certainly coming together for that, because it was an equal threat for any one of them. And also a little unusual for a garter snake to climb like that. Normally I see them more hunting on the ground. But as far as empathy, I think of that as kind of a higher emotion. I don't know if birds, say, quite feel it at that level. But I will say this much. Early on when I was studying animal behavior, the big warning was always, you know, do not anthropomorphize. Don't put human qualities and emotions, attribute that to animals. We should just look at their behavior, their reactions, and the different actions that they have. But I think the more we've looked at least certain groups of animals, we do find that there are some level of emotion among them. How much that is true with birds and to what degree... I guess we still try.
Yet.
Yeah, we don't know. We still study just the reactions and behavior of the birds. Reading into the minds a little bit, there's always, I guess, a little bit of a caution for that. But no doubt there's something going on there in, you know, as a little higher thought process among some of those birds.
Yeah. It's a very interesting story, Jessica. Thank you so much. And thanks for your question. It's an interesting one to consider. And I think I kind of learned that the same way you did way back in the day, Bill, but that has been disproven for me many, many times with a number of animals.
Yeah, yeah. They do things that we didn't always expect.
Exactly. Thank you, Jess. Marcia in Verona, your turn. Hi, Marcia.
Good afternoon. I have a hummingbird. Quick question and a story. So when a hummingbird probably once a year gets caught up in our car garage, it makes me feel so bad because they just will not come down. They don't know to. So last year I put one of those big orange construction cones on top of the car, and on top of the construction cone I put one of my red, hummingbird feeders in. And I wasn't able to stay there for too long because I had, somewhere to go. But when I came back, the hummingbird was either gone or he died out of, exhaustion. But I looked and I looked and I looked, and I couldn't find his little body, if that was the case. So I don't know if just bringing something up high kind of brought him down lower so that he could see the, see the way out. Do you have any...
thoughts on that?
Suggestions?
Yeah. Well, certainly, when birds get into buildings, the normal instinct is to fly up, and that's the problem. They get up into the ceiling areas and are going in circles and oftentimes tire themselves out. For the garage, I guess, first one, prevention, if you can possibly keep the door closed so the birds aren't accessing it. And, yeah, just leave it open. Hopefully they'll find their way out. Trying to lure them out, it's possible if you put something out, as we said earlier, attracted to red colors or even the feeder, putting something out visual that might attract them and show them which way is the way out. That's always possible. Give it a try. It certainly couldn't hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. Marcia, I think it might well have come down. And
show them the way out.
Craig in Madison. Excuse me. Craig in Madison. Hi.
Hi. Just calling with a couple of quick little stories here. I've been having a challenge with the house finches wanting to nest underneath my retractable awning. And unfortunately, it's an area where we like to sit. So I kept, trying to shoo them away. And eventually what I came up with was one of the foam wraps you put on your pipes in the winter. And I put the wrap up where the awning is affixed to the house in the flat area. And I'm sure that finches wanted to make their nest on there. But the wrap up there, the pipe wrap, and you know what? They went and found another place.
There you go.
No harm at all.
Right. Yeah, make it unattractive, unsuitable for them by putting something there. One of the big problems is, of course, the porch light for the robins. That seems to be a very typical one. If you can put something physical on there that just doesn't allow them to build a nest, it's really the best thing that you can do. A number of years ago, we had a pair of ospreys that were nesting in the Northern Kettle Moraine, and they used the ball park. They had just put up the large floodlights for the evening games. And, of course, this was not going to be working for the osprey because you turn on the lights and you boil the eggs. And, of course, it might even short out those intense lights. So the power company put up poles off into the distance with platforms on them to give them an alternate site. And then we took aluminum and made like a roof, sort of a pitch to it, so they could not build on it. And sure enough, they realized this is not going to work here, found an alternate site, and they've been using it ever since. Same thing, just on a bigger scale.
Yeah. Craig, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Rick in Bayfield has something for us. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Larry. I've been out bird hunting a couple of years, and I keep running into the snowy white owl. Not every day, of course, but how common are they in northern Wisconsin?
Okay, the snowy owl is a bird nests in the Arctic, and their primary food is the lemmings, which, of course, have a 4 to 5 year population cycle. So when the population crashes, they look for alternate sites and they vacate the Arctic, moving south. About every year, we'll get birds that are moving out into Wisconsin. And with that, these are usually the young of the year because the adults need to hang on to the large territory for enough food to get through and the young disperse. So we will get occasional sightings scattered throughout the state. Every year, bird watchers are reporting them somewhere. And then when we get the population cycle crash, That's when we get a larger exodus of these birds. And so they like large open sweeps, and they're looking for something treeless like the tundra. So the big open farmlands, farm fields along the Lake Michigan shore, central Wisconsin, the Buena Vista Flats, and unfortunately also airports. And we do have a number of the major airports around Wisconsin, people who are out there to keep the birds of prey and the geese off of there because it's not good for either one of them or the planes. And, occasionally the snowy owls are on these the airports as well. So, again, anything that looks like an open tundra sweep is where they're attracted to. So if you get, say, even a half a dozen birds in all of Wisconsin that bird watchers are reporting in a year, they are here, but they're widely scattered.
Widely scattered. Thank you very much, Rick, for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary emailed us 3 summers ago. They had those terrible wildfires in Canada for many weeks. And they were, you know, there and suffered bad air. But all Mary could think about were the birds. So many birds nest in the forests of Canada. Fires were in the peak of breeding season. Mm-hmm. Do we know anything about how the fires and their smoke have affected bird populations? She says she's looked out, but hasn't found very much information about this.
Well, there was a very unusual effect a few years ago, pardon me, of swallows that were migrating, and these were fires out west. The swallows got into the smoke and actually choked them, and they came falling out of the sky. And that was a very unusual event that these birds were right on course where that dense smoke was. The biggest factor, of course, is the destruction of the habitat. Of course, these forests will recover. Give it a few years, the trees will grow back again. It'll provide a little bit younger growth for one host of birds, and as it becomes a more mature forest without the fires, we'll see other birds that'll come back to it. This is really one of the problems of this changes in our weather and climate change, and that is especially for the forest fires. Most of them are in summertime, right during the nesting season. It's not just the loss of the habitat over the next few years, but it is those birds that are right there at that time, hoping to raise their families, and now having to abandon that. And we also see other events for birds, say weather events, severe weather that hits during that nesting season, and these catastrophic events. And this just makes it that much more difficult, much more complicated for birds that already have a hard world out there to live in. We haven't made it easy for them. And I think people have probably read this, that over the last 50 years, we've lost 3 billion birds that migrated to Wisconsin or to North America. And this is a whole series of different data sets that a lot of birds are just in serious decline. We've seen some real losses, especially among grassland birds. Forest birds seem to be doing a little bit better. But, yeah, it's becoming a more difficult world out there, and anything we can do on small and large scale, from our own backyard to larger conservation efforts, are important because we at least want to keep those birds here. The good news is they can be resilient. If we give them a place to live, we give them that protection they need, they can bounce back. But I don't know if we're making those efforts fast enough or broad enough to keep all those birds going. I try to be an optimist, and I keep hoping that we're going to do that because we all appreciate those birds. But, we certainly have seen those tremendous losses over time.
Lisa in Osseo has something I might relate. Let's go there. Lisa, mm-hmm. Hi.
I live in Osseo, Wisconsin, and we have this solar farm field that might be going like right off the back of my house.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And every summer we get 2 cranes. There's a small pond off to the side of the field. It's a farm field. And we get 2 cranes, and every year they have a baby. And I'm just kind of wondering what the solar field might do to the birds and all the – there's lots of animals that frequent our field here, the field here. But I don't know if I should – we're trying to fight to stop it. But I just wondered if the guest has some words of wisdom on solar fields and animal habitat.
Well, this is a tough one because we're looking for alternative sources of energy. We certainly know that we can't keep burning fossil fuels because we're seeing the impacts and results of that. Man, there seems to be no real easy way out of this. The wind farms, We do know that out in the prairie states that the prairie chickens in particular don't like to have those kinds of obstructions around. They abandon places like that. Solar fields, well, this is a great as passive type of energy, but we are using oftentimes hundreds of acres at a time. If we're putting it in farmland, which is taking a farm field out of production and putting it in a solar, I guess it's a bit of a good trade-off because the farmland, straight row crops, soybeans or corn, really don't provide habitat for birds. So they hadn't been using it for a long time, and they certainly won't with the solar fields. As we develop other land, say as abandoned fields, open land like that, that is providing habitat, yeah, we are crowding the birds out of those types of areas. So, yeah, these are unfortunate struggles because there is no one energy solution that doesn't have some sort of problem. And but the biggest thing is just like in business, it's location, location, location. It's putting these things in there to try to have a clean energy source without creating a secondary problem. And of course, there's a lot of competition for land and it's getting kind of difficult. So
yeah,
I can just say there's no easy solution out there.
Several years back, well, probably 10 years back, solar array went in across our homestead is located. There was corn, sometimes alfalfa in there, in that field, and now there's grasses in there. I see birds in there, and I'm not, you know, there seems to be a food source for them. I think they keep the grasses so they're not so high that that they're blocking. Of course,
some birds can accommodate or become accustomed to that, but the real grassland specialists, those are the ones that already have enough pressure because we don't have perennial stands of grass in large acreages like the original prairies were. And those are the birds that certainly are not going to take advantage of that.
Yeah, I think you're right. Lisa, thank you for calling. Bill Volkert, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. With Bill Volkert, wildlife educator, great to have Bill with us. And you can join in with your own questions as well. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Bill, we've had a question about the wood thrush. And as a person interested in learning a little more about it.
It's, I think most people describe it as one of the most beautiful songs of North American birds, very flute-like. It's just a wonderful song from deep in our larger forest stands in Wisconsin. And if we have a chance, let's take a listen.
Yeah, let's see if we can hear the wood thrush.
And the little mnemonic, do you remember that?
Yeah.
Eole, very flute-like, kind of up, goes
Eole.
Down, back and forth. Many years ago, a fellow from the University Ohio State University, Donald Bohrer, started doing the early recordings of bird songs back already in the 1930s and 40s. And one of the things he did was to slow down the songs to show the complexity. And if we can listen to, I think it's 1/4 speed of the wood thrush, you're going to hear things that to our ears just sound very melodious, but it's incredibly complex and very eerie. They've landed.
Oh,
very
my
otherworldly,
goodness.
Isn't it?
Oh, that's a great song. That quarter, it you think, okay, that's a quarter speed.
Yeah.
At full speed, you, there's a lot going on.
Yes, and we don't hear that.
We don't.
And so the thinking is that they probably wouldn't be putting all that into it if it didn't mean something to the birds. And so I think one of the things that makes bird watching so attractive to us is that, as we said earlier, birds see in color, and so they see quite a bit of the same range of colors we do. There's some evidence that some birds are seeing into the ultraviolet light, but basically they more or less see like we do, and they're brightly colored. certainly for each other, and we can enjoy those various plumages. And they also sing within a range that we hear. The big difference is they seem to not just listen within the same range we do, but maybe listen faster. Birds have a much faster reflex time than us. And so our reaction time is about 3/4 of a second. For pigeons, they've actually timed it to 1/60th of a second. Hummingbirds, who knows what their reflex time is.
Wow.
So why would a bird have such an elaborate, complex vocalization if it wasn't something that they could hear? So we really think that birds don't hear about like we do, except they hear faster and hear more detail. That to us just sort of glances over, and we just hear sort of a general muddle of the tones.
Greg in Combined Locks emailed us. Do you have, Bill, do you have an apprentice or understudy you're currently working with to encourage the continuation and passion for birds and all of nature?
Oh, that's a good question. Not any one person I've, say, taken under my wing. I do a lot of presentations and lectures around the state, and so I like to share this with people and try to encourage people to get out there. Certainly, I would suggest anyone, if you're trying to learn birds, go out with an expert, go to a nature center, go somewhere where there's a field trip, go with a naturalist and have them share their knowledge and introduce you to the birds. I am a licensed bird bander. I do have two people licensed under me. We're trying to get that next generation of research scientists going for banding and following birds that way. No, as such, I'm not mentoring any one individual. I'm certainly always available to share information one way or another. And, of course, if anybody is interested in having me doing presentations, they can just go to my website, and I do offer presentations statewide. You can just go to billvolkert.com, and you can see what I the various topics that I speak on.
Dale in Tomahawk emailed us. He had a Western Tanager at his feeder one day a couple of weeks ago. He used a Merlin, used Merlin to ID it because he was stumped, and wondered how often do they appear in Wisconsin.
It's not, say, infrequent. We do get them. I would say somewhat regularly. Every couple of years, we'll have observations somewhere of Western Tanager. Name implies, of course, it is a bird of the Western United States. We're separated really from its range by the prairie states in the central part of the country, but yeah, it's a bird that will find its way into Wisconsin periodically. Beautiful, brilliantly colored bird, bright yellow with red head. Males can be very striking. And yeah, a bird like that is not something that you might recognize immediately. And I wonder sometimes, certainly the apps are making it easier for people to identify these birds, but I wonder how many times these may show up for somebody who's not that familiar and it goes unreported too.
Colleen in Cumberland emailed us. She'd like to give a shout out to the nonprofit Wild Instincts in Rhinelander. And it's volunteers. She had an abandoned grouse chick, and a volunteer met her halfway today to transport it to Rhinelander to give it care. Grateful to them and the organization.
So rehabilitators. I'm not familiar with that particular one since I don't frequent there a lot. But I know there's a number of rehabilitators that are licensed around the state to help wildlife that's been injured. And that's also an important thing that we can do. If we have those people who have that experience and are willing to take the birds and mammals in, help them recover and get them back out into the wild.
Adam emailed us with some of his birding sightings. He's been noticing a lot of new visitors this year. Morning warbler, Tennessee warbler, red-eyed vireo, and multiple wood thrush pairs.
Oh, good.
He's restored a lot of his property over the last 4 years and notices new birds every year. They help spread his native plant seeds all around.
Well, that's a great measure of success of your restoration efforts. What is the response of wildlife? I mean, that's what we're doing it for both trying to recover some of these ecosystems with native plants and providing a habitat for birds. Morning warbler is a real good one. For most of our warblers, they tend to sit in the middle and upper part of the tree. morning warbler is a real skulker. He likes to be down in the shrubbery. And a bird that I usually identify by its song, he likes to hide quite a bit. And a good list for him. And I would encourage him to keep a complete property list and see how that grows over the years. But I think he's on the right track by providing some restored habitat for those birds and certainly starting to see good results.
Stacy emailed us with a recording of a bird call, Baltimore Oriole, in her yard in the New Glarus area. I can't get that up on my screen, but perhaps Lee.
Nope.
No.
Baltimore Oriole?
That doesn't sound like a Baltimore Oriole. I think she may, and that was her recording. Let's do a recording of, let's get a recording up of a Baltimore Oriole. Lee will find that in a minute, but yep. That does, you know, the Merlin app's pretty good, but it may not.
It's not foolproof.
It's not foolproof.
It is, I would say, 90%+ accurate. And for people who don't have to sit there the way I did it the hard way, try to identify and learn one bird at a time over decades, it is just an incredible tool. But we have found a few errors within the program. No doubt as the library and database grows and as the ability to refine that, it's just going to get better and better. And perhaps it's somewhere down the road, it'll get even better than some of the best bird watchers out there.
Yeah. So maybe I think Lee's got a...
There we go.
Yeah, that's more like it. Come back again. Yeah.
It can be a little confusing with robin, which are both common birds. Robin has, as we heard earlier, that sort of rolling back and forth and back and forth. I think of the oriole as this very clear whistle, very sharp sounding, and he's always got this sort of a very positive, upbeat sort of sound to it. And, yeah, wonderful bird to listen to.
Jay in West Bend emailed us a photo. Every year a robin builds a new nest on his ladder that hangs parallel
see the picture
on the side of his garage. And this year she built two adjacent nests. Eggs were only laid in one, but wondered if that was unusual.
Oh, it's a great picture. Yeah, it's wonderful. It looks like she got carried away or couldn't make up her mind which one to go with. And, you know, it's a busy time of year. Birds will start on building a nest. And oftentimes, like, say, the house wren will build multiple nests, and then female will select one of those. So that it's not typical of robins, actually. But, yeah, it looks like this one got started on one and decided to, rather than improve that, just make another one right next door.
Kathy in Harshaw has something. Let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, I'm a little concerned of the lack of insects on my windshield this spring and what the birds have to eat. I live up in the Rhinelander area, and I haven't seen hardly any insects. And I'm just wondering if that's going to have a big impact on our birds that are migrating back.
Well, that's a good question.
I'm still feeding, and I've been going through 40 pounds of sunflower seeds a day.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, boy.
Well, you're keeping your birds happy.
Oh, man.
So the sunflowers, of course, are going to be something attractive to the finches, the cardinals, those seed-eating birds. The vast majority of our migrant birds are insectivores, which is why they vacate, because we don't have any insects in wintertime. So it's not the cold weather. It's driven by available food. And, yeah, we have seen this tremendous decline of insects. And as she said, the simple survey is just look at your windshield. We just don't get that splatter like we used to years ago. And a lot of the insects that the birds are getting are the ones they're picking off of the foliage. Now, there are, of course, the aerial insectivores, the chimney swifts, purple martins, other swallows, the nighthawks. These are birds that are taking the insects out of the air. One way or another, just that loss of insects, that food base, is certainly, again, adding to the problems for birds. So we have habitat loss, places, you know, less places to live. We've got window collisions. We've got feral cats and pets that are left outside as non-native predators, a whole host of problems. And with this now added to it, the possible diminishing of a serious food supply for the insectivores. Again, it's just simply making it a more difficult world out there. And as I always remind people, when I get asked, so what is really the problem for birds? Is it here in Wisconsin? Is it the wintering grounds? Is it stopover habitat in between? Is it contaminants and pesticides, habitat loss? Well, the answer is D, all the above. And the problem here is in conservation, first we monitor birds' populations through a whole variety of surveys just to see how they're doing. We're starting now with the breeding bird surveys at this time of year.
Yep.
We've got winter surveys, migration surveys, special surveys on certain focus species, and others just in general looking at bird migration and a whole host of them. So if we start to see something decline, that's the warning. Now the question is, what is the cause, which is oftentimes more multiple causes, and which ones can we address and do something about to try to reverse that? You know, when we had the problem of DDT and the eggshell thinning for eagles, ospreys, peregrine falcons, that was a real tremendous success story. It also was very easy because it was a simple cause and effect. It was the DDT, one chemical, and one simple repercussion of that. Ban the chemical, birds are back. Today, conservation efforts are much more complicated because there are multiple factors working against a lot of our birds. And that makes it really much more challenging. But I would also say, I'm trying to be an optimist. Let's each try to do something we can right at home, make our backyards more bird friendly, plant some native plants out there to give them something, do something to address your window strikes and support good conservation around. And then with that, we also hope that on a larger scale, our wildlife areas, refuges, and other wildlands, that those are also restored and managed properly.
Dennis in Madison, and it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks, Larry, and your guest, and everybody of WPR. Yeah, question is on controlled burning of prairie grasses. To me, it just doesn't seem like that can be good for birds at any time. But I'm aware of some people burn prairie grass in the spring for prairie restoration. I don't know if it's ever a good time, but it seems like maybe late fall would be better.
Good question. Now, as far as prescribed burning, well, we do know that if you establish a prairie, especially here in what is the forested eastern United States, without fire, it will succeed to brush and eventually trees. So if you want to maintain grasslands, that is the easiest tool is periodic burning. There's a little bit of research going on. Is it spring or fall? It seems that spring favors the grasses. Fall may favor the forbs or wildflowers for burning. If we do it early spring, it's before the birds arrive, so we're not burning, like, say, we talked earlier about the wildfires that occur right during the nesting season. The one thing that we have, though, is that when you burn, you've removed that residual cover. In other words, those tall, dead grasses. And what we find is that there are some birds that prefer those tall stands, like the Henslow sparrow, where others birds prefer that shorter grass or mid-stage grass. So of all of these birds classified as grassland birds, from bobolinks, meadowlarks, the various kinds of sparrows that use these open lands, there is a different type of habitat for each of those and different density and height of those grasses. So the important rule is if we have a large stand, say of several hundred acres of grassland, first rule is don't burn the whole thing at once. You want to save portion of that as your residual cover where those birds can then move to, and then you can rejuvenate that other site and alternate. And I noticed this when we put in a stand, this was 40 years ago in the Northern Kettle Moraine. We had 200 acres of prairie. And yeah, we lit up half of that, and we saw all the Henslow sparrows all move to the north end. And with that, we really had direct evidence that we need to do just portions of these and in rotation. So it's essential if you want to maintain it, but it also has to, like everything else, has to be done right.
Yeah, absolutely. Dennis, thanks for bringing that up. Joanne in Mount Pleasant, on to you now. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, I have a park, a nature park that I've been going to for about 50 years or better. And the last 2 weeks, I saw a bird I've never seen before. It had a white band on its neck, very about an inch wide. It was a fairly large bird, a little bit bigger than a cardinal, but not as big as a blue jay. And I saw it twice in the same place at this park, and I was wondering what it was. I'm trying to find it in the bird book. I've never seen it before.
It's a white band, but what's the rest of the color?
He has red on his beak, And I was fairly close, but not that close. And then the rest of the body below that, the neck, where the band was just kind of a brown and, you know, a mix of browns and tans. Nothing special.
Okay,
but
when
there
you
was red on the beak.
Okay, if you describe a brown bird with a red bill, the first thing that comes to my mind is the female cardinal. Now, the white band is something that you...
That one, I know.
Okay. A white band is something that you certainly would normally not see on cardinals, but there is that partial albinism that occasionally comes up in birds, which can really throw us because you'll see white where they normally wouldn't have it. Trying to think of other birds, very few in Wisconsin have a red bill. So
yeah,
that kind of,
really,
that really limits the variety of birds out there.
I was thinking right away, well, I wonder if one got away from a pet got away.
Well, that's the other possibility I was going to bring up is we oftentimes will have something exotic out there as well that escapes. And with that, these are things you wouldn't expect whatsoever. And, you know, again, the Merlin app, if you can get a photo, you can use that for photo ID. And that is another very good tool to try to identify some of those. But
yeah, I'd like to see
unfortunately,
that.
Yeah, it's not. Nothing is coming to mind except for a partial albinism or leucistic, a female cardinal. As I say, so few have that red bill.
Yeah, that's right,
Joanne. Sorry, I couldn't be of more help.
Get a shot, a picture of it, Joanne, if you can.
Yeah, if you can get close enough.
Thank you for calling, Dave and Toma. On to you. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, I know that all these other things really affect the bird population. But I'm wondering if the geometric rise of the population of coyotes could be having a disproportionate effect on the bird populations.
They'll take eggs.
Yeah, they'll take anything out there, again, as opportunist. Songbirds probably less so. It's not a big food source for them, but if they stumble across it, they certainly would across a nestlings or something like that. I think that rodents probably is by far more the greatest part of their diet. Birds would be rather incidental. Some of the ground nesting birds, pheasants and ducks, certainly if they can capture them, they'll take it. Is it having a serious impact? I don't believe so. I really can't see that. You know, and every once in a while, you may have a very localized situation where a particular animal gets a taste and an opportunity for something, and you might have a very local impact. But I think overall, the coyotes probably are not having a major impact on, say, most bird populations.
Okay. Dave, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Bill Volkert, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking birds today with Bill Volkert, Larry Mueller here. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Ed and Merrill, your turn. Hi, Ed.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about three different birds. One is the whippoorwill, which I grew up in northern Wisconsin. We would always hear it in the evening. And the second one is the killdeer, which when someone talks about empathy, I was thinking about how killdeers are just so protective and were awesome. But I have not seen or heard either the whippoorwill or the killdeer. And the third is the English sparrow that Gordon McQuarrie, one of the greatest outdoor writers, wrote about when the white-throated sparrow, would sing, it was time to go trout fishing in northern Wisconsin. I think I know, I've heard it before. It's a little bit like a and I remember it as a kid.
Oh,
very good.
White-throated sparrow. You were pretty close.
Yeah.
Lee brought that up right away for us.
And a little mnemonic to help remember the rhythm of that. Oh, sweet Canada, 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 or Old Sam Peabody, Peabody, Peabody.
Yeah.
So that's a nice way to remember that rhythm. Now, you asked about whippoorwill and killdeer. Killdeer is pretty widespread in Wisconsin. Wherever we have some open either mud or gravel is place that they'll place a nest on the ground. And, yeah, they certainly are very protective of the nest. And, of course, the well-known way of getting the predators away is the broken wing act. They will quickly slip off that nest, run a good, say, 20, 30, 40 feet, and then fan the tail and drag that wing so that if a ground predator like a cat or mink is coming by or even somebody's dog is getting near a nest, they're going to do this broken wing act, lure you away, and then as the predator gets close, oh, sure enough, they recover. They fly another 20 feet, and then they'll be calling away like crazy and essentially just lure that predator way off the direction and then circle back again when it's safe. The whippoorwill is a bird that we've seen some real decline in across North America, the eastern part of this of the continent especially. And in Wisconsin, yeah, we've seen about the same trend. There's still a stronghold in central, west central Wisconsin. That's sort of that core area. But these outer areas is where we've seen the loss of the birds. And this is very typical of the dynamics of these populations. In other words, birds are attracted to what is prime habitat in, say, a state or a region. And as that becomes saturated and they're doing well, the surplus birds are forced out into marginal habitat. So where I live, the Northern Cattle Moraine, I would occasionally hear whippoorwill years ago because you had enough of those birds that had pretty well claimed their territory in that prime habitat. Well, as the population goes down, that periphery begins to disappear. And essentially, if we're looking at it geographically, they contract toward that prime habitat. And that's where our whippoorwills are today. I do hear people talk about hearing them throughout the evening in that central, west central part of the state. We still have them here, but it's not what it was in the past.
Let's hear one.
And they will go, yes, that's his name. And they'll go on all night. I've heard some people say, I can hardly sleep for it. I wish I would hear that.
Yeah, I would like to be kept awake. I remember hearing it. Yeah, I remember hearing it as a kid. And we had some that would be outside the window, the bedroom window. And you'd have the window open in the summertime, and here come the whippoorwills again.
Yeah.
It was a great song that I wish I could hear, and I haven't, well, other than listening to what Lee just played for us, I hadn't heard one in the wild for many a year.
Well, you know, that's, again, a little bit of the consequences of the declines of these birds. It's one thing that we now have all these tools to identify the birds, to listen to the recordings that other people have captured, but some of these voices are becoming a little more silent out there in the natural world, too. Mm-hmm. And we'd hate to get to a point where we recorded all of them, and that's all we have of those voices.
Mike in Madison emailed us. He's curious about the bird species Merlin. He's been hearing them regularly on the west side of Madison over the past several years, probably since 2021. Seems like they're moving into Cooper's Hawk habitat. Mm-hmm. And curious if you're aware of any trends in this regard.
Well, the trend is that the population is really increasing, and they are now nesting in places where they were never known before. Now, Merlin is a medium-sized falcon. So the little, what used to be called the sparrowhawk, the American kestrel is the smallest, Merlin is mid-sized, peregrine falcon is the larger of the common falcons we'll see here in Wisconsin. And, of course, the Merlin app takes its name from that bird, as well as Merlin the magician. It's like magic to have that on your phone. So the Merlin is a bird typically of the boreal forest, that northern spruce forest. So the far northern tier of Wisconsin and into Canada was really its stronghold. And I remember years ago where I had found a pair up on the Turtle Flambeau Flowage. There were people, two researchers who were keeping track. They were from Minnesota and tracking the population. And they said, please document that for me. Are you sure? And I do know what Merlin sounds like. And yes, I was able to confirm that for them. And that was, say, 25 years ago. It was not that common in Wisconsin. They've become well-established. And now they've spread out. We've got birds in Waupun, Sheboygan, Madison, a number of these suburban neighborhoods. They love the big spruce trees. And, of course, as a falcon, they're taking small birds. House sparrows is a common food source for them in these urban areas. So yeah, go Merlin.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a bird that has really not only increased in numbers, but moved into areas that we had never expected before.
And the and you mentioned house sparrows, and I did get an email from somebody who comments that they have taken over the neighborhoods, and they, you know, they just drive out other birds, and wondering, is there anything aside from Merlin?
Yeah, attract the Merlin area. House sparrow, of course, is a non-native bird. It's actually not even related to our North American sparrows. And it was introduced back in the 1800s already. And it's most common, we call it the house sparrow, because it's around urban dwellings is the most common site for it. And as we had earlier, the caller about the bluebirds, it can be a serious competitor for some of our native birds. What can we do about it? Well, it's a difficult one. It is not a protected bird, but it's a difficult one to deal with. And and very localized situations, it can be a fairly competitive species with some of the other cavity nesters.
I understand that you have a question for me as we get closer to the end. I may have another one or two for you, but you've got one for me, apparently.
Well, yes. I mean, you've obviously had more than enough time to grow into this job, and I'm just wondering, you know, you're so comfortable and so relaxed. Were you in the early days somewhat nervous or self-conscious? And for anybody who wants to get into radio, do you have any advice for them? Or I suppose most of our listeners are just curious as to what makes you so good. What are the secrets of the trade?
Oh, well, when I started, I was quite nervous on the air. And, you know, like any job, when you start a job, you're nervous. And you sort of get over that as you move along and become more aware of what you need to do and how you should do it. Mm-hmm. So I was nervous. I haven't been nervous in a long time, although I've
the last 50 years.
Been more nervous lately because of the end getting near.
Yeah.
and that sort of thing. In terms of getting into radio, well, there's different ways, of course. And if you're someone's in college, you take broadcasting, podcasting classes. Many of my students have gone on to very successful careers in radio and television and podcasting, as a matter of fact, from taking classes. If you're, you know, long past college or past college, I think one of the ways to get involved in radio is to look at the community colleges, or the community stations. There are tons of community radio stations now, and it's very possible to get involved there to begin with, to get the kind of experience that you need. And when you're in one of those stations, you're doing all different kinds of things that you have to do. Because it's always short of manpower a little bit in those stations. But you can develop practice. And frankly, here at Wisconsin Public Radio, we've hired over the years a number of people who got their experience through community radio.
Oh, sure.
And developed the skill sets. And they also then made contacts that they could use later on.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's my answer to that. You get to know people and you make those connections and that kind of, you know, that's...
And
that's
you just helpful. Need that practice behind the mic.
Yeah, and a fair amount of luck. Everybody I've talked to, I know who's in broadcasting said one way or another, they were interested in it, but then they just got lucky. Something happened.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said, you know, you ought to do this or that, or can you come and work at our station? Clara Napert is an example of mm-hmm. somebody who volunteered at the college level. And, you know, here she is, a really, really good producer here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, definitely.
She's had lots of on-air experience as well.
And I suppose that just with practice, you literally find your voice.
You know, that's a good way to look at it. Well, I've had 59 years going on 60 now. I mean, in that really started my 60th season here in June.
So it's been...
Well, you certainly are a champion, and on top of that, a Wisconsin icon.
Well, thank you, Bill, and it's been a real pleasure working with you over the years. And I know you're going to stay with us. I'll be gone a bit, but Lee Rayburn's got... He's given a thumbs up here because he'll be replacing me here behind the mic, and he and our listeners will be happy to know that you'll be coming back and being here on a regular basis.
Any chance we have to talk about birds. Thank you so much, Larry. It's been really a treat.
Bill Volkert, retired wildlife educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years. And it's been a great experience for me to have talked with him for 30-plus years. Thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.